We're picking up where we left off last week in the book of Ezra, chapter 6. And this is basically the restoration of temple worship. And the nation of Israel is now at, in a right relationship with God once again, because the Jerusalem has been rebuilt. The temple has been rebuilt. The people are living in homes, and now they're able to worship at the altar by offering sacrifices, and they can now go into the holy place and the most holy place once a year for Day of Atonement. And we learn about the kind of dedication and the reenactment of them being able to worship again by them celebrating the Passover. So in Ezra chapter 6, verse 19, on the 14th day of the first month, the returned exiles kept the Passover because the priests and the Levites had purified themselves together. All of them were clean, so they slaughtered the Passover lamb for all the returned exiles, for their fellow priests, and for themselves, which is what they were required to do. It was eaten by the people of Israel who had returned from exile, and also by everyone who had joined them and separated himself from the uncleanness of the people of the land to worship the Lord. So here you have people that are not fully fledged Jews, but now they're either proselyting or they're considered what's called a stranger in the gate. Either one of those categories would fit that description. The God of Israel, and they kept the Feast of Unleavened Bread 7 days with joy, for the Lord had made them joyful and had turned the heart of the king of Assyria to them, so that he aided them in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. So you have kind of the culmination of what they were to do. We went to some prophets last week and talked about Haggai specifically, and how Haggai was kind of the impetus, the motivator behind the people of Israel getting back to work with those two leaders. And so in chapter 7, you get introduced to a guy named Ezra. It seems like he's pretty important since the book is named after him. This is going to have some names. If you remember chapter 2, we read all the names, and we're going to do the same thing here in chapter 7. So here we go. Now, after this, in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra, the son of Sariah, son of Azariah, son of Hilkiah. So if you track that down, Hilkiah is going to be pretty important for us. Son of Shalem, son of Zadok, son of Atub, son of Amara, son of Azariah, son of Marioth, son of Zechariah, son of Uzziah, son of Buki, son of Abushua, son of Phinehas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, the chief priest. So that names, those names were not too difficult. They're not, you know, they don't flow well off my tongue. But the point is, Ezra, the scribe, we'll call him, he can trace his lineage back through Hilkiah the high priest, Shalem the high priest, Zadok the high priest, Atub the high priest, going back to ones that you might recognize, Phinehas. He's pretty important. He did some wild stuff. And then Eleazar, and then son of Aaron, the chief priest. So that's Aaron, the, you know, relation to Moses, his brother. This Ezra went up from Babylonia. He was a scribe skilled in the law of Moses that the Lord, the God of Israel, had given. And the king granted him all that he asked because the hand of the Lord was with him. This theme of people being blessed miraculously or supernaturally is a pretty common one in the Bible. Basically, it's an individual who is living in a blameless way, and the Lord is going to use that person in a very particular way. And because of that, everything that he does will flourish, will go well. My mind immediately jumps to Joseph. I mean, not all good things happen to him, but wherever Joseph found himself in Egypt, with Potiphar, and unfortunately Potiphar's wife, when it came to him being in charge of the inner prison, the outer prison, and then being over the people, second in command of Israel, trying to prepare for a great famine, whatever Joseph did, the Lord blessed him, and that blessed everyone that he worked alongside of. So Ezra is one of those guys. Verse 7, and there went up also to Jerusalem in the 7th year of Artaxerxes the king, some people of Israel, and some of the priests and Levites, the singers and gatekeepers and the temple servants. So this shouldn't be a shock to if you're here at the beginning, but there are three waves of Israelite groups that come from Babylonian and Medo-Persian Empire rule, and they come back down to Jerusalem. It's going to be significant because you kind of have that first wave that came. They laid that foundation for them to go back to the law. Now, the second wave supports them in that work. The third wave is going to do something else when it comes to the city of Jerusalem. So we'll get to that when we get to it. So again, verse 8, and Ezra came to Jerusalem in the fifth month, which was in the seventh year of the king. So, you know, you can go back and trace this. You can see the kings, and there's tons of resources now that will visually highlight what year these things took place and who went and how long they were there and so on. And so if you're interested in that, if that's a thing that you love to learn more about, there's tons of resources. Now, I had to memorize it at one time, but I haven't used it in a long time, so it's long forgotten. But the point is, if this interests you, then dive deep. You know, learn all you can about it, because the more you remember, the more you know, the more it will confirm that this book is accurate when it comes to its dating. If this is the most boring thing you've ever talked about in your entire life or ever seen, fair enough. You're not a history person. And that's fine. You don't really have to go to heaven, right? It is helpful when you look at history books, but the point that I wanted to drive home here is this is not written like a parable. It's not written like an allegory. It's not written like a metaphor that's just a good moral message on how to live in this world, which is significant to point out, especially in our current climate today, because there are a lot of people who look at the Word of God with a sense of respect because it is a good moral message to do good to others and do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, and to love your neighbor and love yourself, and all these kind of trite phrases that away from the context just sound like any other rhetoric of how to live in this world and not do as much harm as somebody else. But I mean, realistically, this book is not written just to give you a good code of ethics. It does that. But this book is written to inform us about the events of the past, including creation, the Creator, why the world that we live in seems so unjust from our perspective. Is there a sense of morality involved in that? Yeah, if we want to, you know, be more like God or be godly, we're going to have to learn about what his nature is and try to attain that goal. So I say all of that to say this. These are some of these passages. It's not written just to give you a code of ethics. It's written to say, we lived it, this is what we experienced, and we know God because of it. And so the more that we can kind of dive into that, mine it for all it's worth, and then to remember some details, it can be helpful. So anyway, for what it's worth, there you go. Verse 9. For on the first day of the first month he began to go up from Babylonia. On the first day of the fifth month he came to Jerusalem, for the good hand of his God was on him. Now he's a scribe. Let's kind of, I'll give you all I know about what that means. What that means is he is someone that knows the book of the law very well. And by the book of the law, I mean specifically the first five books of the Pentateuch, which are the Pentateuch, which we often say was written by Moses. Now, specifically, we don't have information about whether or not he was the actual physical individual who wrote on the scrolls, the original autograph manuscripts of the first five books. They're called the first five books of Moses or from Moses, but he never claimed to actually write all of it. And if you look into the passages that talk about Moses being the author of the first five books in the gospel accounts from the words of Christ, it's ambiguous enough to leave us with the impression that, yes, he had a hand in authoring some of the first five books from Moses, but it's not verified if he was the actual person that wrote it all. It's kind of splitting hairs unless you're really into critical introductions to the Old and New Testament, but long story short, he knew the first five books well. That would include, of course, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, the law, Numbers, and then Deuteronomy, the law, a second time. And so that's going to be important, because if they're trying to restore temple worship and to make sure everyone's bloodline is going through the right path to bring about the eventual Messiah, then you're going to have to know that information pretty well. So he's a scribe. He knows the law. So there you go. Verse 10, for Ezra had set his heart to study the law of the Lord. There you go, first five books. And to do it and to teach his statutes and rules in Israel. So the interesting thing about Ezra is, yes, you can trace his blood lineage back to Aaron, the high priest, and it goes all the way through all those people we read at the beginning of the chapter, chapter 7. But he's not going to really serve much as a priest, although he may be qualified. What he's going to do is kind of be what a preacher would be. Ezra the scribe, he's going to literally in a while make a pulpit, like a platform to stand on. He's going to have all the people kind of sit down, and he's going to read them the law, because most of them had never heard it in its entirety before, and it's going to bring about restoration to the people of Israel. So having a copy of the scrolls and then being able to read them to the people for them to understand and comprehend what the covenant is that they signed up for, it's going to be helpful. So, verse 11. This is a copy of the letter that King Artaxerxes gave to Ezra, the priest, the scribe, a man learned in matters of the commandments of the Lord and his statutes for Israel. So, that's how he is either described by the author of this book or how he describes himself. A priest, a scribe, and a man who has learned the matters of the commandments and statutes, right? So, basically, commandments are things that they were to do for a moral sense would be one way to define it. And then the statutes would be more legalistic kind of rituals that would be involved with the law. There's a ton of information about what people talk about the first five books, and especially the law portion, how it's divided up by the word that's chosen in this particular paragraph to be descriptive of that concept, but that's too deep for us right now. Verse 12, Artaxerxes, king of kings, to Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, peace. So that's how the letter begins. And now I make a decree that any one of the people of Israel or their priest or Levites in my kingdom who freely offers to go to Jerusalem may go with you. So here's wave two beginning. Because you are sent by the king and his seven counselors to make inquiries about Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God, which is in your hand. So he had a copy of it, which is very important to know, because if you don't have a copy, you don't really know what to restore. And also to carry the silver and gold that the king and his counselors have freely offered to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem, with all the silver and gold that you find in the whole province of Babylonia, and with the freewill offerings of the people and the priest, vowed willingly for the house of their God that's in Jerusalem. So again, he's just lending the official support of their funds to be sent with them as well. With this money, then, you shall, with all diligence, buy bulls, rams, and lambs, with their grain offering and their drink offerings, and you shall offer them on the altar of the house of your God that is in Jerusalem, whatever seems good to you and your brothers to do with the rest of the silver and gold, you may do according to the will of your God. The vessels that have been given you for the service of the house of your God, you shall deliver before the God of Jerusalem, and whatever else is required for the house of your God, which it falls to you to provide, you may provide it out of the king's treasury. And I, Artaxerxes the king, make a decree to all the treasurers in the province beyond the river, whatever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, requires of you, let it be done with all diligence. So he has the kind of backing of the king as an official sent from Artaxerxes as well, up to 100 talents of silver, 100 cores of wheat, 100 baths of wine, 100 baths of oil, and salt without prescribing how much. So all the salt you want. Whatever is decreed by the God of heaven, let it be done in full for the house of the God of heaven, lest his wrath be against the realm of the king and his sons. So it seems like a motivation might be that he's trying to appease not only the Jews, but the possibility of there being some supernatural force that would prevent him from being able to rule well over the Persian Empire. So there you go. We also notify you that it is not lawful to impose tribute, custom, or toll on any one of the priests the Levites, the singers, the doorkeepers, the temple servants, or other servants of the house of God. So they were tax-free asylum, right? Why would this be? Well, if you go back and you look at where the priests, the Levites, what land they were given at the end of Joshua, it's a really easy answer because they were given no land. They didn't have any vineyards, they didn't have any farmlands, they didn't have any cities. The Levites were to serve with the tabernacle first and later the temple. And their income financially was dependent on the free will offerings of all the other tribes. And their food was from the sacrifices that the other tribes would, give to God through the Levitical priesthood. And so it kind of makes sense logistically if you have an entire group of people who are tax-free, they don't have any other income besides what's freely given to the temple in the first place. So the king is not going to tax the temple because it's a religious institution. So that's kind of a logical way to come to it. There's a ton of information that I'm unaware of about what other implications there would have been. So verse 25, "And you, Ezra, according to the wisdom of your God that's in your hand, appoint magistrates and judges who may judge all the people in the province beyond the river, as such as know the laws of your God. And those who do not know them you shall teach." And so he's going to establish their own judicial system here. Now the word judges is pretty good, but it might be rendered better as kind of like governors. So you have these different tribes, different lands, different cities, and you have different systems of keeping justice according to the law of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Psalms, and then Deuteronomy to make that work. Verse 26, "Whoever will not obey the law of your God or the law of the king, let judgment be strictly executed on him, whether for death or for banishment or for confiscation of his goods or for imprisonment." So the judicial system of the Israelites is going to be bolstered by the empire, which is kind of going to be a thing for a while because it goes through the Medo-Persian Empire, kind of supports their justice system. And then, of course, you have Alexander come through with his kind of more modern take on it, and they're a bit more independent, we might say. And then after Alexander dies, there's no clear heir, and so all the generals kind of get their own area, and they kind of rule for a while, and that's where Herod comes from. And then you've got the Romans that come through, and then you have Roman rule over kind of another group there. So you have the Romans, and then you have Herod, and then you have the Sanhedrin, and then fast forward, a couple years and you get to Jesus. And so you kind of have an idea of the systems that were in place when it came to what law of the land was there. Well, there was the strict Jewish law, and then there was kind of the law of the king of the Jews from the old empire, and then you have the new rule from the Romans. So it's complicated, right? So anyway, verse 28, "And all who extend to me his steadfast love before the king and his counselors and before all the king's mighty officers, I took courage because the hand of the Lord was on me, and I gathered leading men from Israel to go up with me." So we kind of have a shift here in the English to where we now have the author of this text talking about he was the one that led them, and the one that led them was Ezra. So thus this is called the book of Ezra. Okay. Chapter 8, verse 1. Here's the genealogy. All right. "These are the heads of their fathers' houses, and this is the genealogy of those who went up with me from Babylonia in the reign of Artaxerxes the king." Ready? "Of the sons of Phinehas, Gershom. Of the sons of Ithamar, Daniel. Sons of David, Hattush. The sons of Shechaniah, who was of the sons of Perosh, Zechariah, with whom were registered 150 men. Of the sons of Pahath Moab, Eliahoanai, the son of Zerahiah, and with him 200 men. The sons of Zattu, Shechaniah, the son of Jazahel, and with him 300 men. Of the sons of Aden, Ebed, the son of Jonathan, with him 50 men, the sons of Elam, Jeshaiah, the son of Athaliah, with him 70 men, the sons of Shephatiah, Zebediah, the son of Michael, and with him 80 men, of the sons of Joab, we know that guy, Obadiah, the son of Jehiel, and with him 218 men, of the sons of Bani, Shelomith, the son of Josephiah, and with him 160 men, of the sons of Bebai, Zechariah, the son of Bebai, and with him 28 men, of the sons of Azgad, Johan, the son of Hakatan, and with him 110 men, of the sons of Adonikim, those who came later, their names being Eliphelet, Jeul, and Shemaiah, with him 60 men, of the sons of Bigvai, Uthai, and Zachar, with him 70 men. And so what we're doing here is Ezra is giving you basically the original individual that went away to captivity, and then their sons, and then who actually came back and how many. So that's what's happening there. I gathered them to the river that runs to Ahava, and there we camped 3 days. As I reviewed the people and the priest, I found there none of the sons of Levi. So I sent for Eleazar, Ariel, Shemaiah, Nathan, Zechariah, and Meshallam, leading men, and for Joiarib and Elnathan, who were men of insight, and sent them to Edo, the leading man at the place of Casphia, telling them to what to say to Edo and his brothers and the temple servants at the place of Casphia, namely, to send us ministers for the house of our God. So they took off. All the folks that wanted to go were able to go. Took 3 days to kind of take inventory on who left and who stayed, and they realized they had no people that could actually work in the temple, which is the whole point of the second wave being sent, was they needed more support in Jerusalem. So he solves that by going to get some. And by the good hand of our God on us, they brought us a man of discretion, of the sons of Mahli, the sons of Levi, sons of Israel, namely Sherebiah and his sons and kinsmen. 18. Also Hashabiah, and with him Jezahiah, the sons of Merari, and with his kinsmen and their sons, 20. Besides 220 of the temple servants, whom David and his officials had set apart to attend the Levites. These were all mentioned by name. And so he's saying here, we got enough people to help with the temple, and also the people that help the people that help with the temple. That makes sense. Hope it does. Verse 21. Then I proclaimed a fast there. Now, if you're unfamiliar, a biblical fast could be any number of things, but it usually focuses on abstaining from food for a certain period of time. This is a study in and of itself, but there are very notable instances in the Old and even New Testament where a fast was called to dedicate one's heart, one's mind, one's focus and strength on things that were more important than the daily requirements of the physical body. That's a very fancy way to say they stopped eating so they could focus on spiritual stuff, right? So there was a fast proclaimed there to kind of focus up at the river Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before our God to seek from him a safe journey for ourselves, our children, and all our goods. Because I was ashamed to ask the king for a band of soldiers and horsemen to protect us against the enemy on our way, since we had told the king the hand of our God is for good on all who seek him, and the power of his wrath is against all who forsake him. So he's talking to the king, talks about how great God is, how powerful he is. He's going to bless you if you do his will. And then Ezra felt uncomfortable saying, well, you know, in case our God doesn't show up, could you give us some soldiers to protect us? This is a tricky thing to navigate no matter when you live, right? We trust in God to protect us and to provide for us and to give us what we need. We also have to balance that with the preparation of physical necessities in the future, as God has blessed us, and even protection, right, for our own families and loved ones and ourselves. And so it's a delicate balance, and you can kind of go too far one way or too far the other. You can be a pacifist, if you will, and say that, you know, we should not have any weapons. We shouldn't protect ourselves because the Lord is in control. If he wants us to be saved or protected, he will do it himself. The other swing of that pendulum is the Lord gives us the tools to protect ourselves, and so we should be so well armed that no one will dare overcome us because that's the will of God. I think a bit of the Crusades there, just in my own mind, historically. And I don't know, I think it's somewhere in the middle, like most things usually are when it comes to biblical matters. And any matter, of course, you have that dichotomy. So you have the two polar extremes. Don't protect yourself, and then protect yourself at all costs. And I think the focus is proper preparation as well as faith in God's providence. So that's something for us to think about. I don't know what that means practically for you, but I know what it means for me and my family, right? All right, enough of that. Verse 23. So we fasted and implored our God for this, and he listened to our entreaty. So what's the point of a fast? Well, you're trying to humble yourself, trying to focus on more important things. You're doing it all together at the same time. So your requests to God are a bit more stock behind him, maybe? I don't know if that's the right way to say it. At all, but it's what it seems like on the outside. So, okay, verse 24. Then I set apart 12 of the leading priests, Sherebiah, Hashabiah, and 10 of their kinsmen with them. And I weighed out to them the silver and the gold and the vessels, the offering of the house of our God, of the king and his counselors and his lords and all Israel there present had offered. I weighed out in their hand 650 talents of silver. Let's see if we have So 75 pounds is one talent. So if you don't know, a talent is not just the idea of a skill that you have. It's also a weight, a measurement, right? So if you've got 75 pounds times 650, that's how much raw weight of silver was offered. So that's the idea. And silver vessels worth 200 talents and 100 talents of gold. So again, 75 times 100, somewhere around 750 pounds of gold. 20 bowls of gold worth 1,000 darachs, and two vessels of fine bright bronze as precious as gold. And I said to them, you are holy to the Lord, and the vessels are holy, and the silver and the gold are a freewill offering to the Lord, the God of your fathers. Guard them and keep them until you weigh them before the chief priests and the Levites and the heads of our fathers' houses in Israel at Jerusalem within the chambers of the house of the Lord. So the priests and the Levites took over the weight of the silver and the gold and the vessels to bring them to Jerusalem to the house of our God. So they got all their offerings in order. Then we departed from the river Ahava to the 12th day of the first month to go to Jerusalem. The hand of our God was on us, and he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and from ambushes by the way. So there was obviously other groups in the land as they were traveling from the Persian capital down to Jerusalem, and that was a perilous trek to begin with. And there's a lot of people that are going and a lot of money they have with them. So, you know, that's important. Verse 32, we came to Jerusalem and there we remained for 3 days. On the fourth day, within the house of our God, so the temple, right? The silver and the gold and the vessels were weighed into the hands of the Meremoth, the priest, son of Uriah, and with him Eleazar, the son of Phinehas, and with them were the Levites, Jozabad, the son of Jeshua, and Noadiah, the son of Binui. The whole was counted and weighed, and the weight of everything was recorded. At that time, those who had come from captivity, the returned exiles, offered burnt offerings to the God of Israel, 12 bulls for all Israel, 96 rams, 77 lambs, and as a sin offering, 12 male goats. All this was a burnt offering to the Lord. In case you don't know, I didn't know for a long time, the burnt offering, it didn't consume everything, right? You don't just take all these animals, kill them, and then prepare them the correct way, and then just throw them on the fire and burn them all up. This is also how they ate, right? So they would offer a portion to the Lord, the first portion, the best portion, and then the leftovers, if you will, was offered to the Levites so they could eat. That's how they provided for themselves. So if the people don't offer the sacrifices, the priesthood doesn't eat. So everyone's kind of encouraged to keep this cycle going, which is kind of why it fell off the rails in the first time, was you know, all the other priesthoods and different gods and different sacrifices, and then you neglect God himself, and then you get lost. All right, chapter 9. After these things had been done, the officials approached me and said, "The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the lands with their abominations, from the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites." And so if you remember, when Joshua took them over to conquer the land in his book, they got the major cities out of the way and they took over all the land, but they did not follow what God told them to do when it came to either killing or casting out all of the other tribes or nations that were in the land. They intermarried with them eventually. They have some as slaves that overrule them sometimes in combat. And so you have this group of Israel who is supposed to be holy and set apart because Abraham's promise is going to bless all the nations of the earth through their seed lines. We know that as Jesus the Messiah can trace his lineage back both ways through Mary and Joseph, all the way back to Abraham to Adam, right? So it's a problem because if you have a group of people here who are going to influence you to go after idols again because you married into the family, they're going to end up repeating the same mistakes that landed them in captivity to begin with. And so you kind of get a do-over here of what they should have done that first generation when they came over. So verse 2, "Because they have taken some of their daughters to be wives for themselves, for their sons, so the holy race has mixed itself with the peoples of the land." Keeping in mind here, when they came back from captivity, same kind of concept. They have people in the land, and they find them, and they like them, and they marry them, and now they're all related. "And this is the faithlessness the hand of the officials and the chief men have been foremost. As soon as I heard this, I tore my garment and my cloak, pulled hair from my head and beard, and sat appalled." So, the most dramatic version of grieving here for the sin of the people. Ezra's all about it. Verse 4, "Then all who trembled at the words of the God of Israel because of the faithlessness of the returned exiles gathered around me while I sat appalled until the evening sacrifice." So he sat all day, just tore up about the idea of this holy people finally getting a chance to come back to Jerusalem. And then they go off and they just marry the people that are there, and it's going to be, you know, same thing over again. "At the evening sacrifice, I rose from my fasting with my garment and my cloak torn, and fell upon my knees and spread out my hands to the Lord my God, saying, 'Oh my God, I am ashamed and blush to lift my face to you, my God, for our iniquities have risen even higher than our heads.'" So, I mean, I say it kind of tongue-in-cheek here because it's a bit much just to read the language here, but you get the idea that he's really sacrificed a lot to be able to restore the people to their rightful place before God, and they've already screwed it up, right? So, I mean, I get it. And our guilt has mounted up to the heavens from the days of our fathers to this day. We have been in great guilt. And for our iniquities, we, our kings, our priests, have given into the hand of the kings of the land to the sword, to captivity, to plundering, and to our utter shame as it is today. But now, for a brief moment, favor has been shown by the Lord our God to leave us a remnant and to hold and to give us a secure hold within his holy place, that our God may brighten our eyes and grant us a little reviving in our slavery. So he kind of gets the picture here that the remnant is not as mighty as the great nation of Israel once was. And they've got one shot to make this right. Verse 9, for we are slaves. Yet our God has not forsaken us in our slavery, but has extended to us his steadfast love before the kings of Persia to grant us some reviving, to set up the house of our God, to repair its ruins, to give us protection in Judea and Jerusalem. And now, O God, what shall we say after this? Because we have forsaken your commandments, which you have commanded by your servants, the prophets, saying, the land that you are entering to take possession of it is a land impure with the impurity of the people of the lands, with their abominations. They have filled it from end to end with their uncleanness. That's a little bit of Numbers there, but mostly Deuteronomy that he's quoting. So it kind of gives you an idea. He knows his stuff. Therefore, do not give your daughters to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons, and never seek their peace or prosperity, that you may be strong and eat the good of the land and leave it for inheritance to your children forever. So he goes, look, we get a second shot of the book of Joshua. We get to come in here again and try to do it right. And we've already screwed it up. And after all that has come upon us for our evil deeds and for our great guilt, seeing that you, our God, have punished us less than our iniquities deserved and have given us such a remnant as this, shall we break your commandments again and intermarry with the people who practice these abominations, idolatry? Would you not be angry with us until you consumed us, so there should be no remnant, nor any to escape? O Lord, the God of Israel, you are just, for we are left a remnant that has escaped as it is today. Behold, we are before you in all our guilt, because none can stand before you because of this. A bit flowery, but he's speaking the truth. He says, in light of what God's word says, we were never to intermarry with the people of the land, so we would not be distracted and worship other gods, which would be an abomination to you. We went away 70 years because of that eventually, and now we come back and we do it again. They're guilty. But he recognizes it and he owns it. When he goes before God and says, we are guilty of this, we, meaning collectively as one nation, one unit, he's doing it the right way. This is kind of what Josiah did a little bit when he was king, a little bit of Hezekiah, but it was never really done like this when there were kings in the land. So that's good. So in chapter 10, you can see the section heading. They're going to confess their sin. They're going to make it right. They're going to repent of this mistake that they made, and they're going to prioritize their relationship with God, their creator, over their relationship to family. That's a very difficult thing to talk about in practical terms, but we'll uncover that, Lord willing, next week. All right, guys, we are meeting on Sunday for the first time in a long time to worship God together, just for a Sunday morning worship, and then we're going to be doing our Wednesday night classes like they normally would be. So I will be here Wednesdays from now on. And until we bring in the 7 o'clock worship, I'll be here about 3 o'clock every week continuing the study with you. I appreciate your attention, your viewing, and your comments. If anyone has any suggestions on what to do after Ezra and Nehemiah, I'm open to them. I don't have a Sunday morning class right now, so this is kind of filling my slot for that. And I need it. I need it to be in the Word and search and dig and teach. And so hopefully you can benefit from me needing to do that. So anyway, thank you for your attention. And I'll see you guys on Sunday and then next Wednesday.